Hopefully it won't, you know, it's not brand new.
Bit late, but here we go.
You know, we should get free tacos here, being
right.
The closest
we'll
to the taco
We're going to call to order the meeting for the Senate Committee on Education today, February 26, 2015. Thank you all for being here. Sorry I was a little bit late from some other engagements. And with that, we'll have a... we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 187, and we'll have a short explanation while Attorney General Rosenblum comes on up, along with whoever she wants. And I think we're going to have Lou Frederick, our representative, up as well. I think there's room for all three of you. Cheryl, thank you.
Cheryl Roblin, members of the committee, Senate Bill 187, as introduced, establishes a task force to make recommendations regarding the protection of privacy of students using education software. This bill does have a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. It may have a fiscal impact, but a statement has not yet been issued. It has no revenue impact, and we are considering the Dash 1 amendments at this time.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. My name is Ellen Rosenblum. I'm the Attorney General for the State of Oregon, and I come to you today in support of Senate Bill 187, the Oregon Student Information Protection Act. We've all heard it at some point in our lives, grades follow you forever. As recently as 10 years ago, that didn't mean much more than a manila folder in a drawer. Requesting a transcript was something you did by mail. Like so much else, your student record has gone digital. But it's not just grades. As educational curriculum moves further and further into the cloud, more and more of our children's daily activities are being recorded and tracked. Much of this has to do with the rise of the educational technology industry, or EdTech. The EdTech industry created $8 billion in revenues in 2012-13 and has continued to grow. EdTech promises not just economic growth, but to be a catalyst for real change in our schools. EdTech brings high-tech skills into the classroom via an expanded, interactive, multimedia curriculum that allows for a level of interactivity impossible a generation ago. Some analysts predict that the EdTech industry may ultimately drive at least $300 billion a year in added economic growth in the United States. But this comes with a cost. In the world of EdTech, information is meticulously tracked. Students are tracked as they watch videos, take quizzes, and read books on their tablet. This monitoring continues after the school day. Homework assignments, academic progress, physical location, and web browsing habits are all tracked and recorded. At some schools, students are given bracelets, which monitor their lap time in physical education and how they spend their time on the playground. Consider Newton, a startup company specializing in mining educational data. Their CEO, Jose Ferreira, recently gave a talk explaining how much information can be mined out of a typical student's school day. Data can be measured, of course, in data points. When you search for where to buy chocolate ice cream at 11 p.m. on Google, that gives Google one data point about you. When you rent a movie on Netflix, that's another. Ferreira says that a typical interaction between a consumer and Google, Facebook, or Amazon will result in somewhere between 1 and 10 data points. A student going to school in the world of EdTech, 1 million. It's a staggering number. Newton achieves this astounding result by, in their words, going granular. They not only track the obvious things, like the grades you might have gotten on your last math test, but also things that are far more specific. Not just whether you might have missed the question about the isosceles triangle, but whether you missed the last question about the isosceles triangle, and whether you're missing more questions about the isosceles triangle than the rest of the class. The teacher might even get a pop-up message telling them that you need a little extra help with your angles. The potential for revolutionary change in the classroom is obvious and far-reaching. But when student data collection spills out of the textbook and starts soaking up data of other kinds, a very complete picture of the student is quickly created. Pretty soon, corporations know what that student likes for breakfast, their favorite musical artist, their favorite soft drink, not to mention more conventional information like where they live, what their parents do for a living, their age, their race, and of course their gender. Some of the collected information is protected by FERPA, the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act, which passed into law in 1974. But as you might expect from a statute as old as the floppy disk, FERPA is not prepared for the age of big data. FERPA prohibits the disclosures of standardized test scores, disciplinary history, and other official student records. But it's silent on the bounty of data generated by a student's learning styles or personal interests. And this data has real commercial value. It can be used to target ads to the students and their families, or to build profiles with the potential to follow them from K through 12 and beyond. On at least one occasion, an ed tech firm faced with the prospect of bankruptcy simply bundled up the data they'd gathered on students and sold it off on the private market. This is where Senate Bill 187 comes in. Based on California's Student Online Personal Information Protection Act, or SOPIPA, Senate Bill 187 introduces the Oregon Student Information Protection Act, or OSIPA. At its core, OSIPA is very simple. This bill does not limit the legitimate use of students' data by schools or teachers. But it should be the policy of Oregon that the information you gather from students should be used for their educational benefit and for nothing else, period. OSIPA does this by making explicit that third-party vendors who contract with a school cannot sell student data and cannot use the data for targeted advertisings or to create a profile on students for a non-educational purpose. Third-party vendors can use student data for the development and improvement of educational resources only if that data has been de-identified, meaning that the data no longer identifies individual students. The California bill, which inspired SOPIPA, passed unanimously and with broad bipartisan support. New versions of this legislative concept are being considered in at least 12 different states. This concept makes sense for Oregon. Our school children should have every opportunity to use the new library of educational websites and apps without fear that their information will be exploited for commercial purposes. Parents should be able to send their children to school without worrying about the creation of a record that will follow their child for the rest of their lives and be improperly used. But I also need to issue a brief word of caution. Some have said that the responsibility for protecting the privacy of students should fall on students, or that parents should be given the opportunity to opt out or waive the protections provided by this statutory provision if they so choose. The problem with this approach is that we all have, it's the same problem we all have when our phones tell us that we need to install like a new security update or install a new app. The screen that pops up showing a long licensing agreement or a privacy statement and other information that the vast majority of us will never read. Applying that to the educational context, I'm very concerned that the option to opt out will be buried deep in the paperwork to register a child or will contain language that if a student opts out, they will miss out on an important educational activity. This could easily create the unfair result that a parent who opts out of the protection of the statute would find their child essentially shut out of the opportunities provided by EdTech. For that reason, I believe it is absolutely crucial to the value of this proposal that no opt-out loophole be included. It's simply unfair to shift this very heavy burden to parents and students. California is only the first of many states who will consider this legislation, and it is of particular importance that we strive for uniformity. Creating a patchwork quilt of differing state statutes places a burden on the edtech industry, students, and policymakers. So we ask you to pass this bill as written. I know there are a number of people here to testify, including my colleague, Representative Fredericks. Cheryl Heemstra is here to answer any technical questions that you might have, so I won't use any more of your time at this time, and I am available as well for questions. Thank you so much.
Thank you. We'll let Representative go, and then we'll ask.
Thank you, questions. Senator. Thank you, Chair, and committee members of the committee. Thank you for inviting me. I'm Representative Lou Frederick from District 43, North and Northeast Portland. I'm also a member of the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Information Technology, and we've been receiving some excellent presentations on this kind of issue as well in that committee. And last summer and fall, I, along with Peter Trumba, who's sitting in the audience here, he's a policy and research director at OEIB, we convened a student data privacy work group to take a deeper look at these issues than was possible during the short session last year. First of all, thank you for hearing this bill. I've been working on this issue for several years, and I want to start out, as I often do, by outlining the questions I think we should be asking and what our priorities ought to be. I have bills in the House that are more narrowly focused on educational records, and this one is about online privacy and scrutiny. My remarks are more about the subject of student privacy generally and the threats to our young people and the adults they will become from the implementation of various technologies to probe their lives and store the information gleaned. First, I think we should recognize that technology is running way ahead of policy when it comes to recording, archiving, and potentially publishing a lot of about our lives that we like to think we control access to. For our children, the decisions we make here can have profound effects on their lives decades from now. I first read 1984 when it was a cautionary tale about the future. What will it be to our children, our children's children, and beyond? For those of us who grew up in an era of paper records, what we did a long time ago is the stuff of reminiscing at reunions. Part of growing up is reinventing yourself, and we've had that opportunity. The fundamental question is, who owns a person's story? Put another way, who has sovereignty over a person's story? Now, the capacity exists to record everything from test scores to keystrokes to behavior notes, to online viewing choices, and to transmit that to the cloud, which really means to servers somewhere. The only thing that stands between those records and marketers, recruiters, future employers, or admissions officers, or just curious eyes, is a combination of the regulations we put in place and the goodwill of the custodians of those records. We should not rely too heavily on the latter. Personal information about human beings, as you've already heard, is the currency of the 21st century. There are entities out there that know how to mine that gold. If we fail to put ethical boundaries on the collection, retention, protection, and use of that data, the only justification those entities need to use it as they wish is to say, because we can. So I think we should take a hard look at the risks associated with extending the electronic frontier into schools and a hard look at how we'd protect young people's online identities. That doesn't mean I think we should retreat to paper records or keep kids away from the electronic resources that we use every day. It does mean that I think we should be careful. I had a disturbing discussion a few years ago in my office in which I was told that the protections I was proposing would endanger the longitudinal study. And I said, isn't that backwards? The doors into our children's lives that are being opened through electronic records cannot be easily closed. So I think we should be asking both, what are the benefits of the new data systems and what are the risks? And the first question should include, benefit for whom? To reveal my bias here, I do not believe that we should inflict risks on our young people for benefits that will not be theirs. Now, the justifications often cite the benefit of creating a resource for future research, but that raises a question as to the quality of the data, the relevance of the data, the quality of the research on it, and how that research might be used. For example, a longitudinal study is not valuable by the sheer fact that it is longitudinal. In fact, an instrument in a longitudinal study can lead to a durable attachment to data, even as it's shown to be invalid. Now is the time to question those premises, because we really haven't done so yet. And that goes double for online identities. Kids do stupid things, stupid stuff online. How long should it follow them? And please hold the thought. Personal information about human beings is the currency of the 21st century. If we are not careful, our children may find themselves pretty much stripped of all rights to control their own information, information that is already housed and controlled elsewhere. This information could rise again when they apply for jobs or college or loans or security clearances. Would any of us, and I know of a couple of you up there, would any of us like to wear the identity we created when we were 13? This is not just an Oregon problem. Hearings are taking place in Congress regarding potentially updating the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act to reflect technological advances that were not anticipated when it was passed. We should note that we have much more stringent rules for research involving our physical bodies than we do for potential risks to our identities, our personal information, our history, our stories. So to recap, the issues are, one, sovereignty, who owns this information? Two, security, what is the risk that it could be used in a way that violates that sovereignty or causes harm in the future? Number three, standards, how will we evaluate proposals to collect, store, and access student records? Number four, risks, Risk should always be evaluated as to both the probability of an adverse outcome and the potential severity of an adverse outcome. Quality, number five. If this data is to inform future research, will that research be informed by valid information? And finally, six, teeth. The regulations we put in place to have some kind of some enforcement mechanism behind them. I want to close with this. I'm reminded of a passage in Beverly Cleary's Ramona Quimby, Age 8, which I hope some parents still read to their kids. Daddy, what are you studying? I'm studying the cognitive processes of children. What does that mean? How kids think. Ramona did not like the sound of this subject at all. Why are you studying that, she demanded. Some things should be private, and how children thought was one of them. She did not like the idea of grown-ups snooping around in thick books trying to find out. Well, I don't think you should, said Ramona. It's none of your business how kids think. My point is, what boundaries are we willing to breach or allow others to breach when it comes to our children's lives and stories? Where will it stop? Momentous societal change is being driven by vendors. Policymakers need to take charge. I hope future generations will be able to rely on some level of control over their personal information, that we will protect our sovereignty over their identities, their stories, the selves they are creating right now. Thank you.
Thank you. Cheryl, do you have anything to say, or are you just there for answer questions?
Yeah, happy to answer questions.
Okay. Any questions of this panel?
Senator Somebody's got to ask.
Exactly. Senator Bensugar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Attorney General, you know, with new technology comes new problems. We all know that, and identity theft and everything. But what challenges do you anticipate in trying to enforce this? That's where I always I wonder, how do people like you enforce this stuff?
Great. Well, that is our job, and that's always a challenge, but one in this case that I am more than willing to take on. Of course, we always have the Unlawful Trade Practices Act available to us, and we would hope that that would be a law that would be fairly easy to incorporate this into. If you have other suggestions that you think might work better, we're certainly willing to hear those. Let me ask Cheryl, if I might, to add to what I've said. Hopefully I'm at least on the right track.
And Cheryl, for the first time, identify yourself, please. Thank you.
Certainly. Cheryl Heemstra, I'm an Assistant Attorney General at the Oregon Department of Justice. And as the bill is currently written, it is going to be enforced under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. And with the provision being in 646.607, which is the one without a private right of action. So it would be enforced by the Attorney General and all the tools available there.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we had drafted Representative Frederick's bill, so it's now in the Senate as well, Senate Bill 418, just in case it was needed as a vehicle. But consider me a warrior in your army as it relates to this issue, because I think privacy is the biggest issue that students are going to face, and who owns those records. And those need to stay with the student, the parent, and the teacher. And so do you see, is it your goal to pass a bill in that regard this session along with this committee, or are you planning to just do the task force this time and then work toward a bill in the future?
My goal, my goal would, frankly, I'd love to have us pass a bill this session, if we can do that. A task force is an appropriate thing to do, but I really would like to get something passed, absolutely.
As would I, so. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, Senator Hatz.
Thank you. Just the vision of my story being as a 13-year-old on Google is enough to make me a warrior in your army, too. I very much appreciate you bringing this forward. I know this is a high priority of yours, Representative Frederick, because of the accelerated learning task forces kept coming up, and you too, Madam Attorney General. And so I appreciate you bringing this forward. We just passed a bill on the Senate floor a few hours ago on an unfortunate term that's now in the lexicon called revenge porn, mm-hmm. to try to stop the circulation of some of these pictures. So we didn't do anything wrong, but there are technology is moving faster than our ability to pass laws. And so I think we need to continue pursuing this. And my colleague is right. We have to keep chasing these things. And it's part of our job. So thank you.
Thank you.
you, thank Mr. you. Chair, thank you. Senator Haas, Vice Chair Knopf, thank you so much, all of you, for listening to us today. When I was 13, I was the queen of hearts. I got my in the eighth grade, and I can only imagine the sorts of things, if that had followed me, that I said and did at the time.
No more questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I don't want to get into what I was doing.
Okay.
Right. Don't go there, Cruz.
We agree. So with that, we are going to call a lot of people. We have quite a few on our list, so we're going to try to keep. Do we want to start the stoplight, or do we want to just tell people kind of keep it within 2 minutes? If you have a lot of testimony, just turn in a written testimony. That'll also get looked at. So with that, we're going to start. And I think I'll start without – I don't like the stoplight if I don't have to. So we'll see how we go. So our next group would be Jim Gardner, Ariel Fox Johnson, and Peter Tromba. I thought Jim was here. Well, if he makes it, that's great. He was probably watching.
Okay. Good afternoon. I'm Ariel Fox Johnson. Thank you, Chair Roblin, and thank you to the committee. I'm policy counsel at Common Sense Media. We're a national, nonpartisan, nonprofit organization dedicated to helping kids and families and educators thrive in the digital world. And I'm pleased to testify today in support of OSIPA, the Oregon Student Information Protection Act. Now, as the Attorney General mentioned, in the past, students' information was on paper records locked away in a file cabinet. Now, as technology has entered the classroom, this information is increasingly in the cloud, on apps, and being handled by private third-party services. Technology used wisely can enhance student learning and improve school efficiency, but we need to ensure that the student data is just as safe in the cloud as it was when it was in the principal's office. This is particularly true given the vast amounts of sensitive data collected today by EdTech providers, of which we've already heard today numerous, sometimes disturbing examples, you know, including behavior records, health information, free or reduced lunch status, even what you pick for lunch or where you are on your school bus route going home from school. Now, currently, this student information is at risk. These third-party service providers have no clear limits on how they're to use student data, and there's inadequate security protection of student information. A Fordham study found that a majority of cloud service provider agreements generally do not provide for data security requirements, and they allow these companies to retain student data into perpetuity. Less than 7% of the agreements looked at restricted the sale or marketing of student data. And this is just companies that had agreements. Oftentimes, student data is being collected by third-party apps that a teacher has downloaded, and there's no contract in place with the school. There's overwhelming public concern about this issue and support for measures like Senate Bill 187 that would protect student data. A recent survey by Common Sense found that 90% of adults, whether they're parents or not, are concerned about how non-educational interests are able to access student data. 89% support more security standards, and the vast majority also want it to be illegal to sell student data, want restrictions on ads based on student personal information, and want to restrict companies from profiling so they can target kids or follow them for the rest of their lives based on what they're doing in the classroom or when they're 13 years old at home doing their homework. 86% of Americans agree here that protecting children's safety and their personal information should be their number one priority. And only 11% expressed concerns that regulations here would be overly burdensome for industry. OSIPA would set clear rules of the road for these ed tech providers, whether they have a contract in place with the school or not. It would prohibit them from using student personal information and online activity to target ads to students or their families. Would prohibit these companies from amassing profiles, prohibit the sale of student data, limit its disclosure, require that companies implement appropriate security measures, and enable innovation and research, which is important so that industry can continue to develop educational products that help customize student learning in today's environment. As technology enters the classroom, students deserve a trusted online learning environment where they can thrive and grow. OSIPA would help create such an environment, and Common Sense is pleased to support it today. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
Chair Reblin, members of the committee, for the record, I am Peter Tromba, Policy and Research Director for the Oregon Education Investment Board, and I'm here to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 187 in favor. As Representative Frederick mentioned, this summer and fall, the OEIB co-convened with Rep. Frederick, a group who focused on the key problems and opportunities with respect to safe, accurate, and secure use of student data. This work included the OEIB publication of a report that categorized the key issues, audited existing Oregon statutes, rules, and practices with respect to each issue. We also surveyed similar work in other states and at the federal level. And I invite any committee members or members of the public to consult that report. It's quite comprehensive, and it's on the OEIB website, education.oregon.gov. This particular bill specifically addresses a consensus position of the group. A key problem with respect to maintaining student data privacy occurs locally. Local educational agencies enter into contracts, or perhaps don't even enter into a contract, that involve the transfer of student data. Why is that? Because of the high instructional value for students and the availability of low or no cost options, districts are interested in contracting for these services. The work group identified the varying level of resources across districts for legal reviews of contracts and potential for districts to sign contracts that are not in compliance with FERPA. This bill addresses these issues by providing more protections for students. It holds vendors accountable, not the districts, to define standards by default, and creates less risk for districts and students when they do enter into contracts. And as has been heard before, this approach has already been enacted in California, and it would be good to follow in a similar fashion. It's a crucial step to address the rapidly intensifying use of data for instructional purposes. But I can't underline enough, as a former school person, the fact that there's high value and low cost online instructional tools is a good thing for Oregon kids. We just need to make sure that we consider best practices in terms of writing the contract so that we simultaneously prevent misuse of the data while allowing teachers to do what's right for kids. Thank you very much.
Hmm. Any questions for these two? Thank you both. And Peter, thanks for your work throughout your years in education. Ben Tate, Don Wolf, Lori Satinspiel. Is Lori here? I don't see Lori.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Ben Tate. I'm the Chief Information Officer for the Oregon Department of Education, and I'm here also to testify in favor of Senate Bill 187. As a person that works in the information technology field in education, I can definitely attest to the fact that this is a very difficult thing for us to come to terms with. The last 5 years has seen very rapid technical change. I don't think any of us fully anticipated how quickly the mobile devices would infiltrate everything. The fact that kids now live on their devices is not something any of us saw coming 5 years ago. Cloud providers are also now a lot more accessible. The services they provide, as Peter mentioned, are fantastic. They are very good services. However, our policy has not stayed abreast with the technical change that we have seen, which has created the problem that is in front of you today. I worked before here in Salem-Keizer School District and definitely saw how these tools were being put to very excellent use within the classroom. But as you have already heard, we want to make sure that these tools do not come at such a high cost. I know that IT has struggled to keep abreast with the changes. I can't imagine how difficult it is for our teachers, who are struggling with all of the other burdens placed on them right now, to make sure that they understand all of the different rules and regulations in play, to make sure that they read through all of the terms and conditions. It does not happen. They're attempting to solve an educational need, and so they attempt to get the best tool that they can. The only solution and only advice we have right now is FERPA. And as you heard, FERPA was originally drafted in 1974. The world it was created to protect no longer exists. And I think it's time for us to update our protection to reflect the world that we live in today. I think this bill is a very important step. I think it addresses some of those key issues. It will provide IT as well as education the protection it needs to continue to use the tools that are available without sacrificing our children's identity and future. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Don Wolf. I am the Chief Information Officer for the Hillsborough School District in Hillsborough, Oregon. I come here in favor of Senate Bill 187. As the Chief Information Officer, and it is my sole responsibility to make sure that we have policies, procedures, and security in place for the data that we manage for the 21,000 students of Hillsborough. We take that very seriously. We make sure that we are monitoring and complying with current state laws as well as federal laws. FERPA is a nice tool. It's a great background, but there are gaps in there. As you've heard, the expansion of technology is outpacing what we can keep up with in policy and how we approach the use and storage of data. So for that, I am thankful for a bill that will put some of the onus back on the vendors to make sure that they are complying with a baseline of how we handle our students' data, and that it is the students' data and the district's use of their tools that they don't get to use it for nefarious purposes or purposes other than for targeted educational purposes. There are a number of valuable tools that I am concerned about in this, that if we don't have some thoughtful guidelines and laws around how we handle student data privacy protection, that we could be put at a weakness. The technology is advancing so quickly and the tools are so robust and so useful in an ever-changing world that we have to make use of them. They are far too valuable for our students not to have them available. We just need to be able to protect the students on the backside of that, of what happens with their data for using these tools. So I don't want us to lose sight of that. Our primary goal in our schools is the education of students. Those tools are valuable for that process. But their security of their data is as valuable as any of the tools we're using. I have worked for a number of years as a statewide resource with a number of schools. As you know, many of the schools in our state are less than 2,000 students, and as such do not have dedicated, experienced, qualified IT staff, and are more and more relying on the expertise of vendors that provide services from the cloud. So to have some guidelines and to have some protections in place that will, from the get-go, provide student protection is a priority right now. We need to have that so that we can continue to move forward with the education we offer our students, but not hamper the tools that are available because we don't have the expertise in schools to monitor and maintain that. A couple areas I would like to bring up for as areas of concern. There are possibly and potentially some hidden gotchas for schools as we move forward with such a bill like this. Unforeseen consequences of tool sets that may not be available or contracts that are already in place that if we remove some of those, curriculum and classroom programs could be put at a disadvantage if those were suddenly to move away. So I'd ask that while it is important and we move this forward as a bill that is adopted, that there also be some sort of a committee developed to have discussions with K-12 and what that might mean for those educational programs that are already in place and how we bring this in such a manner that is thoughtful of the processes that are already in place and thoughtful of how we move forward to protect our students. The administration of the rules is also an area of concern. If it falls back on to the school districts to have to make sure that the vendors are doing this, which I know that's one of the overriding goals of this bill, is to remove that, somebody's still going to have to make sure that when they have exited a contract with the company that data is in fact deleted. One of the pieces I did not notice in the bill was a window of opportunity that after the contract is over, X number of days go by, that data is deleted automatically. Right now, it's on the onus of the school districts to go back and review those contracts, know when it expired, and ask for that data to be deleted. I would think that a proactive step in there could be to, after X number of days of the contract terminating, that we delete that data. So I appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions? I guess my only question would be, it would be nice to, if you have any suggestions how some of those concerns could be addressed, we'd love to hear it.
Okay. I don't I don't speak for the entire K-12 community, so if you are you asking for that in writing?
Yeah, in writing it'd be easier, and I don't expect you to be speaking for the whole education. Any suggestions that you might have that might make the bill better or do things, we would love to hear them, and we'll get them to the right people so we can have a conversation about them. And at least we can think about the fears you have or the concerns you have raised as we make this the best bill we can. So I appreciate that. Both of you. Any other questions? No, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Iris Chavez and Otto Schell, did I see? Yep. And Betty Reynolds, if Betty wants to come up. And Megan Schrader.
Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. I'm Betty Reynolds. I'm Vice President for Legislation for Oregon PTA, and I had the pleasure of serving on the Student Data Privacy Work Group convened by the Oregon Education Investment Board and Representative Frederick. Oregon PTA very much appreciates that its voice was heard in this very important issue to parents and to students. The diversity and the quality of the viewpoints considered by that work group and the expertise of the OEIB, the Oregon Department of Education, the Department of Justice, all contributed to some very high-quality legislative proposals. Both Oregon PTA and National PTA support safeguarding student data through such provisions as third-party vendor restrictions on marketing to kids via the use of data collected, on selling data, on compiling profiles, and we believe that Senate Bill 187 provides those safeguards, and so we encourage your support of the bill, and we are very grateful to you and to Representative Frederick, to the Attorney General, and to the OEIB for your leadership in this very important issue to families and to parents and kids.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. My name is Megan Schrader. I'm the Executive Director of TechNet in the Northwest region. By way of background, TechNet is a bipartisan, member-led organization representing over 70 of the nation's leading companies in the fields of information technology, biotech, green tech, e-commerce, venture finance, internet media, and there's one more, but that's quite a mouthful. We work together with our members to promote the growth of technology-led innovation, and since our inception, we've advanced public policy and private sector initiatives that make the U.S. a world leader in innovation. Our members very much appreciate the Attorney General's office in engaging us in Senate Bill 187 and support the goal of this bill to create a law in Oregon that protects students' safety and privacy without compromising their ability to learn in the manner that is best and mostly uniquely suited for them. We understand that the Attorney General's office is looking for a bill that brings uniformity across states. We also appreciate that goal. With these goals in mind, however, TechNet doesn't believe that the Dash 1 amendments to the bill, which model almost exactly the California bill, achieve these goals. The California bill was enacted following negotiations between technology, the industry, and the bill's author. While the bill's final workability was substantially improved from its original form, most technology companies remained neutral on the bill despite support for the underlying concept of student privacy. The reason for this is because the law, as written, has some ambiguous terms and definitions that lead to difficulty with complying with the final product. A few examples. The first is that the bill as written could be interpreted to prohibit many of the activities that are necessary for our members to comply with federal and state laws, ensure the security of the services they provide, customize services to optimally and uniquely meet each student's needs, and innovate in order to provide ever better educational services to students. Another example is that although the bill's purpose is to regulate services that collect student data in a K-12 school context, the ambiguity in the bill's definitions could permit the interpretation of that regulation to extend to non-K-12 services and non-student data as well. Finally, many of our members also believe that the bill should be amended to give parents or students the ability to make a choice about their use of their student information where they receive a clear and conspicuous notice of a user or disclosure and provide affirmative consent through an opt-in. Students and parents should have the right to decide how student information is used and obtain the benefits of that use. Since the passage in California, the technology industry has continued to work on these issues as a result of multiple state bills and federal attention and interest in the topic. A great deal of consensus has been built in the technology industry around what could improve the California bill and the model this is based off of. However, unanimous agreement has not been reached in a few limited instances. There are several amendments, which are not very substantial, that have been proposed to handle some of the issues that have been given to the Attorney General's office by the State Privacy and Security Coalition. These amendments more clearly define the bill's scope and add clarifying languages as to the services and business practices governed by the bill. TechNet and our member companies look forward to working with the legislature and the Attorney General's office to make sure that Senate Bill 187 is a workable solution to protect student privacy. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you very much. I have also seen a copy of some of those, and we'll look at that. I have some concerns with some of that as well. So I anticipate we will get together with a group to have a conversation about where we're going to go. But and I appreciate you being interested in being actively engaged in,
absolutely,
in the process. But I guess I tend to be one of those people who errs on the part of caution, and I will give the benefit of the doubt to the student safety as opposed to the other. And so anything that takes away from that will be hard for me to consider. But I will continue to have the conversations, and then we can go from there. And if we protect it too hard, we can always come back and look at that at some time when we find a better way to answer that same question. So that's just my opinion to you. But thank you very much for being here, because it does show the interest in the industry out there as well. And I know that they have been engaged in
any other.
Thank you both. Senator Dembro? Oh, next one. So is all of the people as we – wait a second. And did you want to talk about this one? Or are you waiting?
No.
Okay. So is there anyone here who would like to say something on Senate Bill 187 who hasn't had an opportunity to talk and didn't get signed up, because I want to give that every opportunity before we move on? If not, we will close our public hearing on Senate Bill 187. And I thank everybody for being a part of the conversation today. Okay, are we ready?
Cleared it out.
You ready?
Yeah.
Wow.
We're going to... As the room starts to clear, and I know that Senator Dembro had expected they were all here for him, but...
it so, takes special talent.
Sorry, Michael.
We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 518. Thank you for your patience yesterday, too, Senator. We appreciate that.
It's fine. I would have rather been here than there, but once again, I prefer to be here to the alternative.
Okay.
It's always a pleasure to be before Senate Ed. I'm Michael Dembro, State Senator for District 23. That's Northeast, Southeast Portland. And I'm here to present this bill, which is designed to be part of our ongoing efforts to getting students the certification, the degree credentials that they've earned, and to lead to greater student success ultimately. Let me just back up on the history of this thing. It really started in 2011 with a bill that the House Higher Ed Committee worked on together with the OCCA that created what was called the Student Transfer Bill of Rights and Responsibilities, which was designed to make transfer from community college to university easier. And one element of it, asked the CCWD, I guess, to look at creating something called reverse transfer. And what reverse transfer does is it takes those community college students who have, they've started at a community college, they have transferred over to a university.
Yep.
They never got their associate's degree. never thought they would need to have an associate's degree because they were going to get a bachelor's degree. And then life happened, or for whatever reason, 5 years later, 6 years later, they don't have any degree. And what their, you know, official resume says, they're considered to have, quote, some college. And, you know, that really doesn't value their experience and what they've learned and their capabilities to be successful in the workplace. And so we created this program, first in a pilot form. I think PCC and PSU may have been the first, and now it's spread to other colleges and universities in the state, where the student can sort of retroactively get that associate's degree awarded. In some cases, using credits that they have earned at the university, they can be wrapped back, joined with the community college, and you know, that allows them to get an associate's degree. And you know, as I say, there's been a lot of success, growing success. There are still some obstacles there. The problem remains for students who start at the university and perhaps find themselves after, you know, 2 years, 3 years at the university. They too have to stop out, and perhaps it turns out to be a pretty long-term stop out. And the question becomes, is there a way that we can value and you know, credential what they have been able to accomplish during their years at the university? Ideally, they'll be able to come back and finish that degree. But, you know, again, depending on people's life circumstances, that may not be able to happen, or at least not for a number of years. So, so the thought is, can we give them an associate's degree through the university, right? Associate's degree, which recognizes 2 years of college achievement. Now, there are a lot of, it's not something that I would want the legislature to create such a program, because there are a lot of questions about it. Who issues the degree? Does it come from the university? Does it come from a community college that partners, you know, with the university? And so, you know, I think there are a lot of questions there. Are there some obstacles that we're seeing still with the reverse transfer as it is now? That there is a body that we created to deal with that question. That's the HEC. One of the primary reasons that we created the HEC was to have greater coordination between the colleges and the universities, and you know, with the fundamental aim of encouraging student success, recognizing student success. So that's what this bill is about. It essentially directs the HEC to explore this, and although the bill in its current form doesn't have the HEC looking into some parallel issues that might be out there, certainly we can add that to the bill, and I think Mr. Wyckoff may be able to address that. But whether we're talking about reverse transfer or this situation or encouraging what's often called a reverse baccalaureate or an applied baccalaureate, these are things that will be, I think, really beneficial for students, especially, you know, as you can imagine, for those in the more rural areas of the state where people are place-bound and it may be harder for them to leave their families to go to school at one of the universities. So with that, I'm open to answering any questions about this now or after John speaks.
I think we'll let John. You're on the next bill, too, so you're still here for a while.
Great.
Thanks, John.
Great. Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Wyckoff, Legislative Director for the Oregon Community College. And I'd just like to start by thanking Senator Deborah for his work on issues like reverse transfer and our Student Transfer Bill of Rights. For us, and especially in sort of the frame, and we know that we all talk about this a lot, but the frame of 40-40-20, I mean, one of the issues for the community college sector is We have, as Senator Dembro pointed out, we have a lot of students who will transfer to a university because that was their goal and never bother to go get the associates because that was not their terminal degree goal. But what that means for the state is we just simply we're counting that student as in terms of the 40-40-20 goal as sort of a failure, as somebody who didn't get a degree or certificate, and this allows the student to have that. And in many cases, the student may intend to go get a bachelor's, but for whatever reason doesn't, and this allows them to go back and have that. But it gives the colleges a better, or things like reverse transfer, just give us a better way of really tracking the work that we do and getting credit for it, especially as we're trying to kind of reach that 40-40-20 goal. one of the issues that Senator Dembro referred to is that around the applied baccalaureate, is there sort of other ways at getting at further certification and degrees for students in other areas? And I think as we look at it in the context of we've just created a much more independent university system where they're able to take initiative on their own in a lot of these areas, and that's more like the way the community college system works. And we really do want to make sure as we're looking at new ways of doing things that we aren't simply duplicating state resources and having sort of, you know, the two systems cannibalize the work that each others are doing. So, I mean, and I think there is in that way a need for some sort of rules of the road. And I think the HEC was really set up to play that role, was really sort of set up to be the traffic cop. But there, I don't want to give you the idea that it's really about sort of protecting turf. What we want to do is make sure we have the most efficient system for the student that allows them to reach the goals, their goals, in the quickest way and in the most efficient way. And so we want to be able to look at things like what Senator Dembro is proposing and something like possibly applied baccalaureates, where an applied baccalaureate just is different than just your regular baccalaureate. An applied baccalaureate could be in an area like something like welding, where what you're really getting is something like a CTE program certificate, but you want to take it further and maybe do management level work, so you're getting math and statistics and parts of a baccalaureate degree that would lead you to, you know, be have better chance for promotion and things like that. So it's really, these applied baccalaureates are really in areas that are not the traditional liberal arts degree. But even there, it wouldn't make a lot of sense for, in our view, for the community colleges and the universities to both compete in the same area. We want to work out and look at different ways to figure out what is the most efficient way to offer such programs or to make sure students get certificated when they get part of a bachelor's degree but not a full bachelor's degree, and really look at this through the frame of what works best for the student and for the state to meet its 40-40 goal. So we look forward to continuing to be a constructive voice in this conversation.
Thank you. Any questions? Yes.
Thank you, just curiosity, what's the reason why universities historically have not issued associate degrees?
I actually don't have an answer to that, Senator Beyer. I mean, we know of, you know, a number of two-year schools that then became four-year schools. And yet, I think in my understanding, when they became four-year schools, they stopped issuing associate's degrees. I don't know if that's true or not. It may be a function of how accreditation works, and that is something that would have to be explored here, you know, to make sure that it doesn't run afoul of national accreditation or regional accreditation.
And if I may, Chair Roblin, Senator Beyer, and I, as far as the reason for why the universities don't offer associates, I think I would agree with that, and we'd have to go back and look. But interestingly, there is a prohibition on community colleges offering baccalaureate degrees. I don't believe it's the same for associates with universities. I have a feeling. I mean, what I suspect is that is more tied to accreditation. But we'd be happy to help get you an answer on that. But it is actually prohibited for community colleges to offer baccalaureates. And again, in this conversation, we would really only be talking about the applied arts areas.
So a whole lot of tradition, and that's the way we've always done it, and
right.
Some turf protection. I know in Europe, a baccalaureate's a three-year program.
True, but they graduate from high school smarter than we do.
And they have medium skills.
Sorry, Michael, it's on the record.
They do, I think, tend to be a year
it's
old.
It's a different structure.
When they graduate.
They have a 13th in high school.
Yeah, they do. Okay.
So, You know, and we do this a lot in high schools. We have kids who don't finish and graduate, but get in and oftentimes go on to a community college or whatever. And when, if they bring a transcript back that has the thing that they're missing, we at the high school will more than likely give them a diploma. I know that at our school we encourage kids to do that. If they were going to move on and they only needed another course, if they could come back and show us that they had met that requirement, you would issue a diploma. So I think there are ways and things that we can do to help do that kind of stuff, and maybe from the whole institution realize that. So I would hope that as we do the same thing, you know, we look down that next level down. Kids go on and get an associate's degree or whatever. They may not then need to have a high school diploma, but if while they were doing their college and then something came up and they left, could we look back and see, do those credits at the community college meet the needs that they needed to have for a high school diploma? So at least we, again, continue to look at ways in which we can help those students find that opportunity because they finished a particular system that they hadn't done before. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and just, you know, in sum, again, I think this is something that the HEC, you know, was set up to look at, right. You know, exactly those questions. How can we create better, you know, more access to students, greater student success, break down silos, create more flexibility while incentivizing partnerships? That I think is really what it's about.
And I guess my last question would be, in this particular piece of legislation, and we haven't had HEC for a long time, so it's a new issue. Your feeling is that by us directing it, we're giving them some extra boost to go after this particular issue. They could do this on their own, mm-hmm. my understanding,
yeah.
without a bill. But
that's correct. But I think, you know, if you look at one of the reasons the HEC was set up was for exactly this purpose,
right.
to take on missions coming from the legislature. And that's what has led to their work on proficiency-based education. It's what's gotten them into the textbook affordability area, et cetera. And this seems really just right in line with that. Let me just say that, as I think I alluded to before, I will want to, if it's okay with the committee, work with the community colleges and the universities to see if there might be some amendments that might clarify some of the charge to the HEC, and that's what I would want to bring back to you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Great.
With that, is there anyone else that was sitting in their chairs and were having a hard time staying in their seat because they wanted to come up and testify on this bill? Seeing none, we're going to close our public hearing on Senate Bill 518, and we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 519. And do you want to do an explanation, or should I? Yeah, let's do that. I haven't done that for a while today.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Senate Bill 519 directs community college districts to use a uniform budget and accounting system. This bill may have a fiscal impact, but a statement has not yet been issued. There's no revenue impact, and we are considering the Dash 1 amendments at this time.
Okay, and with that, if Michael would like, we can have Lori Wimmer, and John, if you want to come back, you're certainly welcome to sit up here, too. Thank you for that. And
yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, Michael Dembro, State Senator, District 23, Northeast, Southeast Portland. And I'm pleased to present Senate Bill 519. I'm not going to go into detail. I'll leave that up to my dear colleagues to the right. But this is something designed to create greater transparency in how community college budgets are presented, and hence they can be better analyzed. I believe that there has been that the Dash 1 amendments reflect an agreement between the different interest groups that would you know, that people are satisfied with. And with that, I will leave. Thank you.
That's fair. Thank you. you have you're comfortable
and go away.
Are you comfortable that they can answer any of the questions that might come up?
I think so. Okay. I hope so. Certainly better than I can.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
All right.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for your record and committee members. Lori Wimmer, representing the Oregon Education Association. My written testimony is in your system, so I'm just going to briefly give you the overview of the purpose behind the bill as we intended it, which was that the Community College and Workforce Development's website does not provide comparative revenue and expenditure data for public viewing. And public data access is currently limited to summary college profiles and a tuition and fees section. Financial information page that is publicly accessible that goes into more detail is more than 5 years old. It's a 2009 budget only. A link exists to data and reporting website for more current data, but it's a restricted page that locks out the public. If, for instance, one wishes to compare one community college to another, the Community College and Workforce Development site is no help. The public has a right to know how all public institutions collect and spend their resources and how they set their priorities. And so our bill attempts to afford that information access. We worked with the Oregon Community College Association, who we'll speak to in a minute, about ways to tweak the bill to meet their needs with respect to making sure that we're doing this in a way that's harmonious with their community college needs. And I think we have an agreement in the Dash Ones, and we hope that you'll agree as well.
Senator Roblin, members of the committee, Chair Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Wyckoff of the Oregon Community College Association, and we do, in fact, have an agreement on the Dash 1 amendments. And the information, we think the information that is currently behind a login wall was not a few years ago, and it could have, in fact, been in a lot of, there's been a lot of turnover as there's been a big restructuring in at CCWD, and that this may have gotten lost in the shuffle. It was, in fact, information that our executive director was recently looking for, and was looking for very similar information to what the Oregon Education Association may have also been looking for. So we all agree that this is information that should be publicly available, and are happy to help make that happen in a constructive way. And I think the Dash 1 amendments reflect a way to do that that is consistent with the way that CCWD collects and provides the information, and that wouldn't cause a fiscal or cost them to hire programmers to create new systems. So we're very comfortable with the approach that we have all agreed on.
Okay. Any questions for these two? So I guess my question would be, the Dash Ones are ready. Okay. That's a good thing to hear. With that, is there anyone else who, again, would like to speak to Senate Bill 519? Seeing no others, thank you very much. We will close our public hearing on Senate Bill 519. And I would expect, committee, I'll check with you, but I expect this one will be coming to a work session near you soon. March 3rd sounds fairly soon. With that, we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 473. We'll have a short explanation by our administrator. And Senator Gilson, do you want to sit down there? You want to sit up here? It's up to you. And is Representative Nose? Yes, there we are. So I thought. So you can both take a seat up front if you'd like.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Senate Bill 473 requires each public university, community college, or other institution of higher education to allow students, faculty, and staff to identify sexual orientation on forms used to collect demographic data. This bill may have a fiscal impact, but no statement has been issued at this time. There's no revenue impact, and we are considering the Dash 1 amendments at this time.
Very good.
Okay. Chair Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rob Nose. I'm the state representative for House District 42, which consists of inner, southeast, and northeast Portland. And I'm here today to express my support for Senate Bill 473, along with Senator Gelser. We're sponsoring the bill together, and the Dash 1 amendment. So this bill has the potential to help our state achieve some of its desired outcomes for student success and graduation rates by allowing universities and community colleges to track a subset of the student population, gay and lesbian, bisexual, or transgendered students, who may or may and allow us to know how they're doing with regard to achieving their educational goals, eventual graduation, and employment following the completion of a course of study. Senate Bill 473 will allow students, faculty, and staff at colleges and universities across Oregon to voluntarily identify their sexual orientation on forms that are already collecting demographic data. The data can then be aggregated, and then it can be used to help track the progress of these students, again, who identify as gay or lesbian or bisexual or transgendered with regard to how they are doing in school. So, you know, we know that gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgendered people face homelessness or joblessness or hunger and other disparities at disproportionately higher rates compared to other heterosexual and cisgender peers. We also know that we track all sorts of data within higher education: age, race, gender, levels of financial aid. This bill will help in terms of tracking data in the aggregate to know how these students are faring in school. Senate Bill 473 also allows students to use a first name of their choosing on certain college documents such as class lists, campus directories, student ID cards, and diplomas where it's not legally prohibited. So now, why is this important? The reality is that some of these students would prefer to not use their given birth name. They may be victims of stalkers or survivors of domestic violence, or prefer a name that conforms to their identity, wanting to be called Nick instead of Catherine. Allowing students to use a different name, a name of their choosing, recognizes their lives and experiences, helps to create a more welcoming environment for which they can truly succeed. Most of the youth in our public K-12 schools already have this option, so why not extend it to post-secondary education? The -1 amendment helps to make that option just a little bit clearer. Finally, it's important to know that this bill won't mandate that anyone disclose their sexual identity in any of these forms. Disclosure of that information will remain optional. With that, I urge your aye vote on Senate Bill 473, and I thank you for your time here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sarah Gelser. I'm the state senator from Albany and Corvallis. Some of you may find this to be familiar. I introduced a very similar bill last year and came and talked to most of you about it. I introduced it at the request of a student at Oregon State University. We, at the end of the session, the system said, give us a little bit of time and we'll see how far we can get without legislation. Come back to us if we need to clarify this to make it uniform across the universities and the community colleges, and that's the place that we're at right now. I really appreciate the universities being helpful in developing that -1 amendment. The part that's new that we didn't talk about before was the idea around the preferred name that, as Representative Nose mentioned, is important to a whole lot of students. It could be students who are in transition, could be, as he said, students who are survivors of stalking or domestic violence, and as my local university pointed out, in some cases it's international students that are wanting to go by a different name on their class rolls when they are on a U.S. campus. So happy to answer any questions, but I know we have some pretty strong panels here to talk to you about why it's important to them.
Yes, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, Representative, great idea. I have no problem with this at all. The one concern I have is the reporting phase, and I'm assuming that the institutions already do some kind of report like this. Could this be in that has demographics, I mean, something that has demographics. Is this something that could be added to that, or is this
another report that's going to be required?
Yes, Senator Roblin, Senator Beyer, yes. And, in fact, some campuses are already doing exactly what's in this bill, some but not all.
I was thinking more of the report that's required to be made annually to the legislature and ACC.
Is there a report in this bill?
No, there is a report in the bill, unless I'm reading it incorrectly.
I believe that the intention of that is to be reporting this in the same way that we do all of the other demographic information.
Right.
So any report that is including information about
demographics,
this is just adding to that menu of demographics.
Mr. Chair.
So it's not a separate new report.
My understanding, somebody probably more knowledgeable about this than me can explain, but it's not a new report.
Okay. Any other questions in this group?
Nope.
Seeing none, thank you both. So with that, we'll call C.M. Hall and Jared Rowe.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
The last time I saw C.M. Hall, she was ASL sign interpreting the governor's inauguration.
I remember
that is
that
correct.
As well.
My first I think so. So yes. I'll just begin. Chair Roblin and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 473. As mentioned, my name is C.M. Hall. I coordinate the Western Region Interpreter Education Center at Western Oregon University. I also teach LGBTQ studies at the university, have done that for the last 3 years. And I've worked in higher education for the last 9 years. I'm also a member of the board of Basic Rights Oregon, our state's leading advocacy organization for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender Oregonians. And we represent tens of thousands of Oregonians from every corner of this state, and we're strongly urging your support of Senate Bill 473. Senate Bill 473, as Senator Gelser and Representative Nose have mentioned, is a simple bill, and I'd like to take a moment to walk you through it. It would require public universities and colleges to add sexual orientation and gender identity to their list of routine demographic data already collected on existing forms, online and in paper form. It allows universities and colleges to update their forms at the time of reprinting to avoid incurring additional costs for new forms. But as mentioned, many have gone online. Like any other demographic information, it is optional for anyone filling out the form to participate by disclosing information regarding their status. It would also require universities and colleges to allow students to use a first name other than their legal first name on campus records such as class lists, school directories, student ID cards, and diplomas. It is a modest but important proposal to collect important information to address these disparities and protect the safety and privacy of students. In 2008, there was a survey conducted. According to this survey, Too Afraid to Learn, more than 3,500 Oregon college students acknowledged that there was a hostile campus climate that had a significant impact on the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender student population. The findings included the fact that 10% of LGBT students took more than 5 years to graduate due to anti-LGBT sentiment. More than half of LGBT students concealed their sexual orientation on campus for fear of personal safety, discrimination, or rejection. And more than 60% of all students reported witnessing instances of homophobia, ranging from homophobic language to violence. As a member of a university staff, data collection matters to me both personally and professionally. I want all students to get the support they need to thrive at Western and at our other public institutions and ensure they are empowered to do so. Faculty and staff strive to provide the support individually, and collecting data on the experiences of students, faculty, and staff would help our institutional practices catch up to our individual practices. Over this past year, Western Oregon University has already begun to track this data, and we need to do this work consistently so that we can analyze how to better serve LGBT students and support their retention and academic success. This is a bill that strengthens Oregon colleges for all students, and allowing these students to have their identity known and their name acknowledged will be more consistent for our ability to serve these students in general. So Basic Rights Oregon fully supports Senate Bill 473 in its entirety, and we urge the committee to move this forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Roblin and the committee, I'd like to thank you for allowing me to testify. My name is Jared Rowe. I'm a first-year student at Lane Community College, majoring in speech, and I'm here representing the Oregon Student Association, or OSA. Today, I'm here to urge you support for Senate Bill 473. I think we can all agree that support is an important factor in one's education, and it can often be the difference between failure and success. For example, in my personal experience, I have narcolepsy, which is a disorder that basically means random daytime sleepiness. I can fall asleep even right now, maybe. Won't happen, but it might. So before I got diagnosed, I would often fall asleep in the class and stuff like that until a teacher finally told my mother to take me in. Without the support of the institution that I'm in and the outstanding support from my parents and my teachers, I would not be able to overcome this, and I would not be speaking here because I would not be in college because I would be too sleepy to even notice that I've dropped out. This is why I feel strongly about this bill. While I feel that my needs are very accommodated for my narcolepsy, as a gay man, I don't feel like my needs are very met by my college. This is an institutional problem because they can't collect data on me or my community. For instance, one of the problems we need to fix is more supported counseling. Right now, we have counselors for the Women's Center and multicultural centers on our campuses. However, there is none for the LGBT community, which desperately needs it. And that's why this bill provides a very good solution, and it's very effective, even though it's simple. The collecting of demographic data on LGBT students allows schools better access to and meet the needs of LGBT students. As the person before me stated, that there has been substantial civil data collection on other places such as race or ethnic differentiations, and it has helped those groups make change in the past, such as with discipline when it was found out that people of racial and ethnic minorities were disciplined more than those of the majority. And we believe that they became less invisible, and that's what we're asking you to allow us to have. We want to become less invisible. Now I want to remind you that the LGBTQ community is in no way a small collective of people. For example, at my school, we have the Gender and Sexuality Alliance, which often holds events pertaining to the problems faced by the LGBT community. This is a representation of this problem, though. This is a student-run organization. We need recognition from our schools, and we need to have data to show us show the challenges present in the schools and to be recognized by the institution which we operate in. Thank you.
Thank you. And any questions for this group? Sim, I might ask you, because I've known you for a long time, and you always read everything. So there is an issue with regard to whether there's a separate report that has to be actually done to the legislature. In looking at it, it looks like this is a new report that comes here directly, as opposed to an addition onto another report. Do you have any idea about that?
I don't, and I think that's what you're saying, Chair Roblin, is the collection of that data. Is that right?
Yeah, the collection of that, and
the aggregate data.
The aggregate data coming to the legislature.
Right, because I know this is so new that Western has even begun collecting this. I don't think we have enough raw data collected to deliver, but I would like to see it, you know, over the 1 to 2 years to be able to give you something, right? But initially, I don't think we have enough information because we've just begun doing that this last year.
And Mr. Chair, I misspoke. I was thinking of a different kind of report. The intention behind this language and whether it accomplishes the did you know these are touchscreen?
Yeah.
I didn't. So the whole screen just moved. Whoa.
Pretty exciting. Yes.
Sorry,
<That's okay.
laughs> just took me by surprise. The intention there is to have a report come back to ensure that the forms have been developed and that they're making progress on getting there. I understood the question as a new, like a separate demographic report, but the intention was to report back to make sure it's happening.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Thank
very
you.
Much
Thank
for
you.
Both of you. Next, we have Christian Mello and Rebecca Mathern.
Hi, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. My name is Christian Mello, and I'm a student at Lane Community College, and I'm also here with the Oregon Student Association. And I'm here to express my support for Senate Bill 473 and share with you why I believe this legislation is necessary. I've been a student at LCC since 2008, and I'm a computer science major. In the 2 years I took off of school, I began to learn a lot more about myself, such as coming to terms with the fact that I'm bisexual. When I was able to afford college again, I returned having a hard time finding a community or resources on campus that would help me better understand my identity, or really just who I am in general. It took me investigating on my own and joining my college LGBTQ student union, as Jared said, the GSA, to really discover what it meant to provide services for the LGBTQ population on campus, or even what it means to be an LGBTQ individual. I learned that I'm a part of a large and proud community of individuals that really just want to be heard and oftentimes are misunderstood by institutions just because we're considered such a small population. It took me using resources of my fellow students to learn how to advocate for myself and other members of the LGBTQ community. In fact, the only resource for LGBTQ students on my campus is a student government position, as a matter of fact, and it's called the Gender and Sexual Diversity Advocate, and that person is actually me. We need professional support staff and resources on our campus, and I know this because of students I work with and hear from every single day. With clear and consistent data collection across the state, decision makers like yourselves will have even more information at your disposal, which will help compare outcomes and disparities among our student population. And of course, this bill also allows students to use a preferred first name rather than their legal name on certain college documents, class listings, student directories, etc. And this is crucial for transgender students, survivors of domestic violence, and victims of stalking to be able to change a first name without having to jump through legal barriers, which can often be really costly, especially towards community college students. Senate Bill 473 is a simple bill that's going to help our institutions better support students that they are meant to serve. And with that, I urge you to vote yes on Senate Bill 473. Thank you.
Hello, Senator Roblin, members of the committee. My name is Rebecca Mather, and I'm the University Registrar at Oregon State University. And today I'm here to actually provide testimony on behalf of all seven four-year public institutions in the state of Oregon. And I would like to say that we wholeheartedly and without reservation support this legislation. We support all aspects of it, the gender identity, the sexual orientation, as well as the preferred first name. And in particular, we're very fortunate to have the opportunity to work with Senator Gelzer to provide the Dash 1 amendments to this. And for the preferred first name, the Dash 1 amendments really allow the institution to ensure that that preferred first name flows in all of our data systems to every system where a student might interact with a faculty member, an advisor, another student, or other aspects of the institution. So for a student's experience, we want that preferred first name to essentially go everywhere the student is going so that they're identified by that name that they are choosing to be identified by. There are two areas where we appreciate the ability to keep that legal name intact, and it's on the official transcript and enrollment verifications. And the reason that this is helpful to students is it allows them to ensure that when that record is attached to things such as health insurance or applications for federal aid, their name is connected to their legal name and there's not any discrepancies in information or any opportunity for other organizations or educational institutions to make discriminatory decisions based on the fact that names may not be connecting. So as a result of having that opportunity to make those amendments or work on the legislation to make those amendments, we are in full support of this legislation, and we believe it allows students the rights that they deserve on campus and the flexibility to make changes as necessary. In addition to students who might have a gender identity that is something other than assigned at birth, we believe that this also allows for international students to use what we might consider an Americanized version of their name. And the third party that we feel like this assists is so many students who might have a family name that's a legal name. And since the day where they were born, they've gone by what is their middle name. And this also allows them the opportunity to do so at the institution. So all seven four-year public institutions support this legislation, and we encourage you to do so. So thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for these? Thank you both. Next, Joaquin Ramos and Heath Oldman.
Yeah. So, Chair Roblin and Vice Chair Knope, and members of the committee, I urge you to support SB 473, the data collection for LGBTQ students. I am a sophomore at LCC, and my name is Heath Altman. I am majoring in pre-pharmacy, and I'm representing the Oregon Student Association. This bill will allow us to level the playing field for all the LGBTQ students on campus as far as the way that curriculum has a heteronormative right now. Way too often I'm in a speech or a psychology class, and we have segments of the class that are dedicated to talking about relationships, and these relationships are between a man and a woman, and that are discussed. And while I'm fine with discussing that, it never comes back to discussing maybe a same-sex relationship or other gender relationships. And so since it never comes back, it sort of solidifies for me how invisible I am on my campus and how we aren't being represented. We just don't. It comes off as like a disregard for us, but I realize that it actually means that that our numbers aren't being counted on campus. I have personally been a witness to many LGBTQ students being forced into unsafe environments. There's a severe lack of gender-inclusive bathrooms on campus. There's not much knowledge about what a gender-neutral pronoun might be, or even how to accommodate that. And there's somewhat of a disregard for a preferred name. This bill will allow not only the preferred name, which is very important to a lot of us, but also give us a statistic to go by and say this many students are on your campus, so this many students might be in this class that you're in. So the sort of talking about only heterosexual relationships or only talking about cisgender people might not be a very inclusive curriculum. Whenever we are forced to sort of explain and introduce our identities to instructors and just hope that they understand and can accommodate for us, we really realize that our struggles and our lives are invisible to the institution that we're putting money and work and pride into. This bill will definitely help campuses shed light on the LGBTQ community, and we can begin work on a welcoming community with high enrollment and success rate for LGBTQ students. It'll allow us to better access the issues that we face, and all of us are here today in order to find our voice, and we're hoping that that voice reaches you and also reaches our campuses. Thank you so much.
Good afternoon, Chair Roblin and members of the committee. My name is Joaquin Ramos, and I go to the University of Oregon. I study ethnic studies in French, and I'm here asking for you to support Senate Bill 473 as well. The reason that I wanted to talk about this is because I entered the University of Oregon with that. Like, I didn't come out. I told myself that I was not gay, which was a lie. And about halfway through the year, I decided to come out to my parents and to my friends, and I could not find anyone that I could talk to that related to the issue. I was not involved in the queer alliance that we have at the university or anything like that. So I spent a lot of nights like alone just crying, and it was a really difficult time for me, and my grades reflected that. And That's why I would like to support the bill, and it's because it's really important that you know that there's people that identify like you at the university and that can help you through things. When there is knowledge about the population at the university, there are resources available to this population, which helps students, especially if they are trying to better their life by getting an education and trying to be successful. So it could increase graduation rates. Also, so when there's more resources, that creates a support system, and the community can be larger. And even though like people might not come into the community and might not use the resources or might not be in the queer alliance or things like that, knowing that there are people that identify similarly to you is really important and really helps students. I also like to talk about the first name policy. This increases the community as well. It makes people feel more inclusive. It makes people feel more safe within school spaces, which is really valuable and is really helpful. And I would like to say that even though this is, we're talking about universities only, this should also reflect state legislature, that it should be easier for people to get to use their preferred name at the state level as well as within a university. And it should be supported. So I ask you to support Senate Bill 473, and thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you both for being here. Is there any questions for these? Thank you both. We have Milo. Is it cool?
Wernikova.
John Weisskopf. Weisskopf. Yeah. And Ellie.
Just
L. L. Okay. L. Malon.
Good afternoon, Chair Roblin and respected committee. For the record, my name is Milo Wernikova. I'm also here as an independent individual. I'm not here part of an organization. Some of you already know me outside of the committee, so I am also putting on the record that I'm not here as Representative Nelson's intern, and I'm also not here speaking on behalf of Portland Community College. I'm here in favor of Senate Bill 473 for the very fact that I am a queer college student. I do happen to go to Portland Community College, which the city of Portland and the community itself also lives in a glass bubble where we are used to diversity. We are used to the fact that everybody is different and everything is awesome in its own way, but then there's other individuals in the state of Oregon that don't have that luxury. Personally, I am in favor of this because of numerous factors that are very personal. I come from the state of Indiana, which, yes, I know Senator Gelser is very favorable of, but... Senator Gelser, I'm actually originally from Fairmount, which is 45 minutes north of Earl College.
My grandfather was born in Fairmount. I'm very rich.
Which is very awesome. but I'm also from various parts of Indiana, which is both diverse and very conservative, which Oregon is just as similar. Personally, I'm in favor of this bill because the fact that this is my first time going to a community college or any university for that factor, and the fact that I'm also 30 years old and just recently surviving domestic violence in a very destructive manner, I had to find ways of rescuing myself. I have only been in Oregon for almost 3 years, starting in September. For me, coming to a community college or a public university of any sort, I didn't first foresee the idea of a queer student alliance. I didn't even take into the fact that I could go to a university that would offer such of a thing. The idea that a bill would be requiring the community college or a public university to obtain the demographic of, is this student LGBTQ or anything of the queer umbrella, was outstanding, though I was hesitant at first. Because of that domestic violence relationship, and the reason why I am in Oregon is because my ex has decided to cyberstalk and cyberbully myself and my family. That also means I had to change my name. Obviously, when I use the name Milo Kova, it's because that's the chosen name I have. When you hear the name Christopher Werner, not many people know who you are talking about. As a queer student, I have, as my sociology instructor would say, I have the balls of fire because I am very passionate about what I represent. 12 years ago, when I was 18, back in Indiana, I created the second largest LGBT youth group in the state of Indiana, known as PRISM. It is the second largest compared to what is well known as Indiana Youth Group. With that youth group being created, I was able to reach out to community schools and to Ivy Tech Community College to help connect and help create a program where people could actually come together, no matter the age group. That way, they didn't have to go to a bar, and they could have that connection. Ivy Tech Community College was able to obtain that idea and was able to create a student alliance within their own confines that was not stressed by instructors, but was only used by their students. Not only does this bill present potential of better understanding of what their students are, it also, if you read between the lines, creates an opportunity for more resources for their students. Whether, as you have heard from other speakers today, whether it is counseling, more programs and more alliances, classroom education becomes better. But it also opens students up to a sense of security. As I mentioned before, Milo is not my legal name, but thanks to the community college that I do go to, I am able to use Milo on my paper, on my ID, on my emails, and of the such. If I were to transfer to Portland State University, to any other university, would that opportunity, would that freedom travel with me? That's what this bill will have the potential of doing. I won't be able to fear, oh, am I going to have issues? But I will have the right of being able to use the given name that I have given myself. I do encourage that this committee take an open mind and open heart to what was being said to you today, to also put yourself in our shoes. What if 20 years ago, 30, 40 years ago, this same thing happened to you, whether it was cyberstalking and bullying, which obviously back then that didn't occur. But what if it did happen to you? How would you react? How would you want your university, your college, to help you? In conclusion, I urge this committee to take this bill and push it onto the floor with a yes vote. I will answer any questions as an independent student.
Thank you. You go ahead, and we'll let John.
Me?
Yep.
Okay. Chair Rublin, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Elle Allen. I'm a student at University of Oregon, and I'm asking you to vote in support of Senate Bill 473. So on the data collection portion of this bill, I think it's really important. Everyone has touched on upon this. Administrators are unwilling to prioritize us because they don't see us as there and they don't see us as important. Trans students at the UO have been trying to get admin to give us an advocate all year, and we keep hearing, well, we don't know how much good it would do. So that's something we really want to build so we can know, so the UO knows that the students are here and the students need this support. Furthermore, monitoring the number of queer students that come in and the number of queer students that drop out and the number of queer students that graduate will tell universities how many, what support students need during the coming out process while they're at school. So I think that most people have been talking to the data collection portion and done it very well. So I'm going to move on to the first name policy, and I'm just going to try and explain to y'all what this means for a trans student going through college. Okay, so this is an absolutely critical thing for trans students to have access to going to college. I remember when I was having to email my professors at the beginning of every single term, I would have to email them, I would have to give them my legal name and say, but please never use this. Please use this name instead. And professors, most of them sort of tried, but they didn't do much. And like, trans people often experience this intense psychological pain when confronted with things that are barriers to their transition. This can manifest in a lot of ways. It's a huge contributor to the enormous trans suicide rate, why the trans community commits suicide at a higher rate than any other community. But it can also manifest in other ways. Anxiety, depression, other things that keep you from focusing and keeping you from learning and keep you from being a good student. It can also manifest in obsessive thoughts. I know a lot of trans people who have obsessive thoughts about just lighting their body on fire when they're faced with things like being unable to transition because their professors and everyone around them and on the name on their ID is all wrong for them. So I would encourage you for the not only for like trans students' ability to succeed in school, but trans students' ability to stay alive. Please pass both portions of this bill. Thank you so much for hearing my testimony, and I urge you to support Senate Bill 473.
Thank you.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, John Wyckoff, Oregon Community College Association. Wanted to just offer some a couple of quick thoughts for us and our and our support for the concept. We're probably a little bit late to the party in that the conversation started in the last session between the then Oregon University system and advocates of the bill, where the Oregon University system was working through, I think, some of the technical issues that our folks are currently looking at. One of the differences for us from the university system is I believe the university system all uses the same Banner system. The system is called Banner to do their student data collection. And we use more than one system. Most of the larger colleges use Banner. Some of the smaller colleges use a less expensive system that is really tailored towards smaller colleges called RogueNet. So they've been looking, and we've been asking them over the last couple of weeks to look at what would be the technical, if to the degree that there are technical barriers to this. And it comes down to as they're updating, in some cases, they will need to do some reprogramming. However, we're very confident we can get there. Just need to make sure for us, and we're working, and really appreciate working with OSA, with the Oregon Student Association and Basic Rights Oregon, to make sure that either the -1 amendments or if there need to be subsequent amendments that can deal with what we hope are some very minor technical issues. But again, feel very confident that we can get, that we can make this work and get everybody and the advocates and our students what they're looking for and the information they're looking for and the ability to use their preferred name. But at the moment, we're just trying to make sure there aren't any unintended technical issues around the two different systems that we use.
Any questions of this group? As you know, I didn't look. This doesn't have an emergency clause. I didn't think it did.
Let me double check.
No, I'm pretty certainly it doesn't. So that gives you some more time. Okay, that's what I was about too. So. Yes.
And just quickly, too, I'm sorry, Chair Roblin. The other piece of the bill that may deal with this is it really directs the Higher Education Coordinating Commission to work with the colleges and universities to set up a timeline. And so that may be adequate, but we just want to sort of, in an abundance of caution, want to make sure that that does cover any issues that we have. But again, we feel confident that we will be able to work with the advocates to make sure that this meets everybody's needs. And by the next time it comes before you, we should be there.
So what I'm hearing you say is you have no problem with the policy. Your issue is whether the technology you have in place is capable of doing what you need it to do.
Absolutely.
Okay. That's fair. Any other questions? Thank you very much. Is there anyone else that wanted to testify that didn't get called up or didn't put their name down? I see none. Therefore, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 473. We had mentioned that we might have some testimony on Senate Bill 84. We're already past time, and so we'd already written on our agenda that we're going to carry that over to Tuesday, March 3rd, for any testimony on that bill. And with that, see nothing else, we will close our meeting on the Senate Committee on Education today, February 26, 2015. February 26, 2015.